We're going to talk about a ritual tonight, by special request of an expert ritualist. But we're not going to talk about particular rituals that you may know of in your various organizations, churches, chapels, synagogues, etc. We're going to talk about the principle of ritual and what it is about, what it was devised for originally. And to do that, we have to go back about 500,000 years. It's not difficult in the imagination. I want you to go back to a period when human beings were living together and had not yet separated from each other. They had not spread out, so there was no real sense of alienation. The type of this relationship is seen in the child in utero. Imagine the baby inside the mother, and the energy of the child and the energy of the mother are interpenetrating. What the mother feels, the child feels, and when the child feels something, the mother feels it. If the child moves, the mother feels the movement. If the mother moves, the child feels the movement. I want you to think about the psychology of the child in utero and of the mother. We'll have a few examples from members of the audience, audience participation, mothers of the world unite, and I want you to tell me something about those of you who had babies, legitimate or otherwise, how you felt when you first knew that you were pregnant. Any offers? Excited. Who said that? You felt excited. What were you excited about?
Like a flower going to open.
Excitement like a flower going to open. Any other offers from pregnant ladies?
Trapped.
We have to remember that there are always a pair of opposites in any proposition. There's an interesting, exciting aspect, and there is a frightening aspect. Whenever you get something, you always get a pair of opposites, because there are responsibilities, there are rights. There are rights and privileges. And we have to remember this thoroughly, so that's what we're going to talk about next. When the woman first finds herself enlarging, can you imagine what the first woman felt like before she actually delivered herself of this mysterious cause of the enlargement? Ladies, what would the first woman feel like? She feels exactly like the first time a woman has a child and hasn't had one yet. She's seen some outside, but she doesn't know that she can do it, does she? She's not certain. I have actually seen ladies with what are called wind children in the business, where they go up, then they go down again. Nothing happens. Now, how did the first woman feel when she found herself enlarging and then she felt kicking inside her? How did she feel? Frightened. Gross? What does gross mean in that context? Large and solid. She was actually becoming packed with something or other. Her organs were being displaced inside. Something was happening and she could feel movement. What would she think the movement was? Crocodiles? Wild rhinoceroses wandered in and trapped? Or something else? God? Good idea. A god was about to be born. If we go back a long way, we actually find this is a real belief. There are a lot of primitive people. And it still exists in Yiddish Yamamas. My son is a god. You know about this. It's called the Messianic Complex. Every Jewish boy is a Messiah. It wasn't a new idea in Moses' day. It was a very old idea. We go back 6,000 years. That looks a long time from now, but it's nothing at all compared with 500,000 years ago. When this process occurred inside, the psychological state of the woman who was not yet aware of what it was that was inside, and whether it would simply mean she would expand, or whether at some point she would burst, or whether there would be some kind of mysterious provision and there would emerge a new life. And what happened in the old days, before men, with their empirical investigations, knew anything about it, what happened to a woman when she was pregnant, and no other woman had been pregnant in her presence, and the men knew nothing about it? What did she do? Where did she go? What would you do?
Hide.
Yes? This is very important, isn't it? Because there is a tendency, when any really important biological process occurs, to hide. Because you don't know what is going to happen. It could be something that would turn the other beings against you, or for you, and you don't know. So you're ambiguous about it. Now, you hide, that's part of it. There is a secret, something about it. And we find this secrecy running later on through history, through all rituals, and something kept secret, in case. Even today, in case. Because when a woman is pregnant, she doesn't know what she's going to deliver, whether it's going to be an antelope or a businessman. It could be anything. That's right, her business. Personal, private, and very, very internalized. Right? When we go back in this way, in the imagination, we are indulging in a piece of creative imaginative play, and we find that what we are actually doing is dredging up from the depths of the unconscious by feeling what might have occurred. Now, no being knows anything other than the modalities of its own being, does it? Can it know anything other than the modalities of its own being? You can't. I can't know a light over there. I can only know the impact of something on my retina, which I call light. If I project it over there and focus and converge my two eyes on it to get a distance, I'm really doing a trick on myself. I'm projecting it. The real sensation there is in some organ inside my head, and I project it. My real processes are internal. They are secret. Nobody can see them. They could infer them from similar behavior externally in me, from something that's happened to them. You can't know anything about somebody else unless you know something about yourself. So the first thing about rights we recognize is that they have two aspects, an inner secret aspect and an outer shown aspect. All the trouble about rights that develops later on, and the wars and the slaughter about them, because all the wars of the world have been about rights of one kind or another, are caused through lack of awareness of the inwardness of the right and too much concentration on the outwardness of the right. Now imagine this situation long ago, when a very simple thing occurred, like a woman becoming pregnant, and a new thing emerged into the world. Now imagine when this child is delivered. Again, what does the woman feel like when this creature emerges from her being? What is her relation to it?
Joy,
closeness, intimacy, great relief, and fear.
It's more than that. It's something of her. It's two in one.
It's something of her.
Yeah.
Well, at least she knows it's come from her body, that it wasn't there before, so she must believe she's had something to do with it. Yeah. Seriously. So there's a oneness there. There is a joy there, providing the thing doesn't immediately turn around and bite your hand off. It's joyful, providing the thing goes well. It could be very frightening if it didn't go well. You always have this ambiguity about it. Now, when this being comes into the world, let's assume that it comes into the world perfectly happily, in a perfectly relaxed way. And then let's assume that another pregnancy occurs later, and there has been fear. There has been, perhaps, death through animal jumping on husband. And this pregnant woman brings forth a child. What is she thinking now? How is she going to take the new child? It will be slightly different, won't it? She may be more tense. The birth may be difficult. Now, from comparison of these two things, the easy and the difficult, came this concept of right. Put RT in your mind as the basis of it. Right. Now the R means the differences, and the T means the crucifixions caused by the differences. This is a base, the base RT, which occurs in ritual, occurs in the word right with a DH in it, and the RITE without the DH. The DH means effort, strength, power. The absence of it means form without power. But the original of it is there are differences, and the differences fixate you, they pin you. Ritual, the right, is concerned with this. How can I fixate in my mind the differences and equate them with the crucifixions? The crucifixions, if you like, are the things that you get pinned on by your own activities. Let the R represent vibration, a differentiator. If you get a bucket of coal and shake it, then the big pieces will come to the top. They come to the top because the little ones fell down. That's very important when you come to consider government. Big men at the top are not big because they climbed up. They are not at the top because they are intelligent. Never make that mistake. They are at the top because the others fell down in the shake. There was a shake, there was a vibration, there was a shock, there was a looseness and a movement. And in that movement, all the little ones fell down. And as a result of this downfalling, there arose the larger pieces that could not fall down through the spaces that were too small for them. So the big ones have arrived at the top because the little ones fell down. And they've fallen down because they were little, perhaps physically, like babies, or because they were afraid, because they had been hurt before, or deliberate downgoing because of consciousness of the responsibility of going up. There could be a variety of reasons for going down. The important thing is to remember the ones on top are there because the others moved down. When you go home, shake your bucket of coal. If you've got an electric fire, shake that, and you won't get the same result. Unplug, please, before doing exercise. Now, if we look at this word right, the RT, every single act that you do creates a difference in you. You cannot do an act, even what you call the same act, twice in the same way. The reason is, when you do an act, you change the distribution of energy in your body. You change the distribution of nervous energy. You change the synaptic knitting in the ends where the sparks jump, where the nervous impulse jumps over the gaps. The gaps change. They become easier to jump. You condition yourself by the things you do. This is the essential of ritual. When you do something, you condition yourself. That is to say, you pin yourself, you crucify yourself. So you write T for the little cross, R for the thing you did that produced the difference. Now, if we take this RT and reverse it, we get TR. This is the basis of Torah, of law. Law is repetition. There is no law unless the act is repeated. If an act occurred once, uniquely, and never occurred again, it could not constitute a law. A law means some kind of behavior pattern, some way of energy operating that repeats itself often enough to be recognized. It must happen at least twice. And you'd have to be very sharp to see that it had happened twice if it only happened twice. If it happened three times, it's a bit better to recognize, and after 3,000 million, then it is fairly easy to recognize the form of the repetition. So Torah, law, rota, rotation, repetition, and ritual, the rite, are really the same word disguised, manipulated to aid meditation. Now let's think about this very carefully. When you do something, no matter what it is, you are conditioning yourself, you're conditioning your organism. Using the hand on your little finger, you mentally put physical body. If you do something, you condition your physical body. If my friend Gerhardt undertakes to do a little exercise of balling up, and he lands on the floor in his exercise, he conditions his body. Did you condition your body on Friday, big girl? Yes. Yes. Is Andrew Freeman about the place? Yes. Did you condition yours a bit?
Yes.
Yeah. You did a similar exercise on Tuesday, didn't you?
Yes.
Haven't you found that through doing it on Tuesday, on the Friday you approached it with not quite the same innocence that you did on the Tuesday, and that something had happened to your body, hadn't it? So that you actually had a modification of your physical body's behavior from a simple little exercise. One little exercise, that's the R in the ritual, had established, had pinned itself in the body, had crucified itself, and in the process it had modified the body, in this case of our two participants. A couple of ladies did a similar exercise, rather more gently, Greta, Margaret, and in the process, what did you derive, Greta? Did you modify yourself in any way?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite a gentle exercise, wasn't it? And although it was gentle, you modified your body in the process. In fact, you cannot act in the same way in the same situation again now, can you? Something has occurred. Now, this something that has occurred and has established itself in your body is the T in rite, in the ritual. The thing that you did, the actual activity, the thing we call the mudra, the posturing gesture, the activity, that thing has altered your body irretrievably. You can never go back, Greta, can you?
No.
You can't get rid of it. If you tried to repress it, you'd be using energy that you weren't using before.
It would be impossible to repress it because the feeling has been so intense since doing it that if I was to repress it again, I know it would be totally different.
Well, supposing we actually gave you a drug. I've got one in my pocket here actually now. I could give you a little pill and you would completely forget that exercise.
The body
doesn't. And as soon as the drug wears off, up it comes again. Also, in trying to make you forget in this way, we've added something to you that you didn't have before. So again, the fact that you did the exercise has committed you to a reactivity to a new situation in a new way, hasn't it?
Yes.
So, engram, grain, grind, push in, nail in. The R is the difference, the differentiation of your body, basically. And the T is the fixation in that body of the record of the act. So the T is the little cross, the crucifixion. Terminal letter T in the Hebrew alphabet, the Tau, or Tav, that letter means a cross. It doesn't look like a cross in the Hebrew. It looks like two other letters. But it is a cross. And originally it was a cross. Now, in the particular form in the Hebrew, the two letters that compose that letter are a resh and a vav. That is to say, a differentiating, vibrating energy and a nail. Vav is symbolically, in the Hebrew language, in any good Hebrew lexicon, a nail, a hook, something that fixates you. The resh means your tongue, that which enables you to talk, to differentiate. So in that one letter, we've already got the same concept. Now let's examine this concept, because this particular letter tells you something. The human tongue, that's the resh, and the vav, the nail, the hook, is a euphemism for the male organ, for sexual drive. Now, the human tongue rules the sexual drive. And we're going to follow this through this discussion of ritual. We're going to go right back to the beginning. There is a woman. How does she become pregnant? How does the first woman become pregnant? Well, she is what is called inseminated. And in the process, a difference is introduced into her. Something happens, an energy comes into contact with an inner energy that she has, and as a result, a process occurs in her, a genital process, a genital relation, the gen part means generate, and this has imposed on her a very peculiar thing, a relationship which in primitive languages would be called a dual relationship. There is now not one me, but two. We'll assume that Daddy's gone on hunting, not knowing anything about it, and he followed a rabbit to get its skin to make the baby bunting, etc., etc. He's gone away like a good Greek hero, and he's forgotten about this woman because he saw something terribly interesting and chased it. And he ran from wherever he was in the Babylon Euphrates site up into the Arctic Circle. And he found the sun didn't set up there at the time. So he made a note of that and then sailed over the ocean and discovered America long before Columbus. But he forgot all about his commitments. In fact, actually, he never had a commitment in our modern sense. He fell into a situation. So there is this lady, and she now has this new God. Now, God is an equation. God is good. The word God and good are the same word. You stretch out the O in the middle in English. The Gott ist gut in German is the same thing. And this idea, whatever you worship, whatever you are prepared to praise, must be for you a good. If it's not a good, it's not worth praising. If it isn't worth praising, it's not a God. The highest, the supreme good is called God. If you want a simple definition from a theologian about what God is, he is the supreme good. Notice he's got to be supreme. We don't say he's the most inferior, horrible, deficient, inefficient, nincompoop. We say he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's omnipresent, he can do anything and everything, and simultaneously we can't get at him because he's invisible. Now, these are the ideals for the human mind to attain to. God is good. That means to say that whatever the word God means or whatever the word good means, they both refer to the same fact, to power, to intelligence, to presence. Power, intelligence, presence. Put those three together inside your body. You have power. Move a hand to prove it. Don't take it on trust. Don't keep it intellectually. Move something. You've got something. Move it. You've got power, presence. If you don't move your body, that's the mudra, you will not get the message. It's a horrible truth. You know, modern, especially Western audience, if you say something and ask them to do something, they feel embarrassed. You know, scratch the end of your nose like that. Don't be shy. How many of you can make yourself do it? And how many of you feel, I can't do that, it embarrasses me? Is it true? Did you all go like this? I saw one or two people that didn't. Now, why not? If you don't do it, you don't get the same benefit as if you did do it. This is the whole meaning of the mudra, mantra, yantra, tantra. That is to say, if you wish to extend your powers, you must do it. Thought it was too easy? No, they didn't. There's an unconscious belief that somebody might look at them and see they didn't do it right. True. You see, we have millions of years of people, long before we were in condensed growth bodies, doing things unright. That is, not RT conscious. You do something and you immediately are fixated. I know a fellow, I don't know whether I'm going to discuss somebody tonight. It's possible. I won't use any rude words. I'll tell you what actually happened. A man had his finger up his nose in a cinema. Quietly in the dark. He believed he was unseen. And suddenly his wife's elbow went up his elbow. This actually occurred. Up shot the nail, high, and blood poured all over his new suit. Now, I want you to imagine that never again in the cinema when with the wife did he put that finger up that nose. Never again when he put a finger up his nose anywhere did he do it with a woman on the same side. Okay? I'm talking essential ritual sense now. You might think it's a joke. It isn't a joke. It's very serious. Because it actually scarred him inside and out. Yes? I could tell you other stories. Similar, but I won't. You can make them up as you go along. Your protoplasm is full of them. Right? Now, physical body, if you don't move it, if you don't create a difference in it, you will not become aware of what is hidden in it. There's an infinity of possibilities in the physical body. Do you know what prepping the knob is? It means hitting your sacrum at the back of your head. Can you bend over backwards and knock your sacrum at the back of your head? It's called prepping the knob in the business. They do it in circuses, and they're quite good when they can do it efficiently without too much groaning in public. They have to exercise usually about 4 times a day to keep it up. But it's very interesting when you can do it. And when it's done very easily, the audience doesn't think anything about it. They say something like, she's double-jointed. They think people have double joints when they do that. They don't think it's hard exercise. When you do something with your body, you differentiate your body. Now, I want to remind you to remind yourself that your physicality, your materiality is energy. There is no matter that isn't energy. So if you do something with your body, you're doing something with an energy system. And this energy system will never be the same again in all eternity. You're not just changing your body for a few minutes or for a few years. You're changing your body permanently. But this body of yours is energy. It is a mass of energy. Organized by what? We'll find out by what. On your little finger, put your body. Bend your little finger one way, it's fairly easy. Bend it the other way, it's difficult. There's a right way of treating your little finger. Which way does it bend better?
Forward only.
Forward only. Bend it the same distance backwards now. You'll break it. You've done it before.
No, I haven't actually broken it. I can feel the resistance.
Very good. And you have had ancestors who have been told to keep quiet by breaking their little fingers.
Yeah? Yes.
A method I used to use with my little sister, actually. To help her to keep secrets. She was a very good secret keeper when she was 21. It didn't do much damage to her character. It just bent her finger a bit. Now, keep that firmly in mind and then say, not only have you got what is called a physical body, which is energy, but this physical body is actually experienced by you through feeling. So on your ring finger, you put feeling and life force. The symbol on your little finger is Mercury. You know, Mercury is the god of commerce. And commerce is concerned with commodities, with materials. So your material body, we put it on the little finger and we mark it with the sign of Mercury. Do you know how to make the sound of Mercury? Does everybody know how to make the sound of Mercury? You do a half circle with a full circle and a cross under it. Or quickly, you do the sign of Taurus with a cross below it. Those who know will be watched by those who don't know, and those who don't know will find out by watching those who do know. That's called initiation. Now, this life force, imagine it. When this thing that was causing this lady to swell comes out, when it comes out, what does it do? Nothing? Does it go onto the ground? Does she gaze on it like that? All that time for that? What does it do? Gerhard? Volunteer, please. Primal scream. That's what I mean. We can all do it. Did I ask you to do a primal scream before, Gerhard? Not that he can recall. Because he doesn't want to go too many millions of years ago, when we had a similar encounter. Anyhow, he knows what a primal scream is. So this thing comes out, and again, Gerhard. What does she do with it? How does she interpret it? Does she say, that's primitive language for clean me up and feed me? Does she say that? Is she that smart? And does she go, my God, where's my husband? She doesn't know she's got a husband. He could have been eaten by crocodiles while he was out hunting. What does she do with this howling thing? What else does she do, Jess? Put a foot on it? She might. She might think, my God, what's that? Okay. You pick it up. And say, good gracious, I produced a thing that can make noises like I can make. If this isn't proof that I'm its mother, whatever it is. Because I too have made such noises. That's why he's gone hunting. He's out of range. So, she now knows that this creature has something that she's got. She can actually feel by identification, by the noise and the sound of tearing parts in the vocal development. Did you hear the shredding sound in that melodious... Where's Sheila for me? Melodious note from our friend Sheila Hunter. Sheila?
I'm here.
It's funny, isn't it? Every time I look at you, I can't see you.
Am I very
much fun? Yes, dear. Will you give me a nice melodious cry of a very gently born baby? Easy birth, caroling, the anti-stroke to Gerhard. New baby, melodious, on the vowel, ooh. Best quality production?
You're putting...
Prima donna?
No, you're putting a horrible dome on it. How do it the way that I feel it's got to come through?
I hope it's nice. Such a baby. That's what I call, what's his name? Reed Dick, is it? Something? Easy delivery technique. Right? Now, supposing it had been twins. Gerhard and Sheila together. Are you ready? Calm down. No, she's the baby. Special type of baby. Okay, now you're both born simultaneously, not one after the other. Countdown. 3, 2, 1, 0. Now, what does the mother do with this? What does she do with it? In some ways, this one reminds her of Daddy chasing the pig to cut its throat. And the other one reminds her of what? Herself in her best wheedle day. In the days of her wheedling, when she used to sit on a rock combing what she had of hair. And there was a lot of it in those days, you know. You didn't just comb this, you know, you'd comb this and this and this. How would you like to comb a hairy wife, Gerhard?
Lovely.
Now, she's going to show differential responses, isn't she? Yeah? Is she going to cast out the roaring shrieker, or is she going to say to herself, My God, a potential cutter of pig's throats, provided of food. And the other one, potential rival, Wheedler. She's going to make some kind of differentiation, isn't she? Now, this differentiation is this letter R again. And the result is that she's going to T, to tie them up in different ways, isn't she? For every R, there is a T. For every difference you can detect, there is a T. You see the difference of body, and then you see a difference of life function manifested in some kind of behavior, movement, sounds. So there is your, on your ring finger, life. And on that finger you put the symbol of the sun. The sun symbol is a dot in a circle. A dot in the circle for the sun, because the dot represents the sun itself, and the circle is the orbit of any planet around it. And all the planets get the energy for their life from the sun, which is a step-down transformer from the solar field. Now, life. There's a ritual about life. There's a difference. Now, why don't you tell me what is the difference between your physical body, inert, sitting there, and the fact that that sitting there body is breathing, and that you can feel it. Feel your body, feel the movement of your breathing, and feel what is the difference between your feeling movingness in that body and what you might call the clumpishkeit of your body, the solidity, the tendency to settle down and spread a bit. Can you feel it? Feel the mass inertia of your body, that's the grossness of your body, but feel the internal movement of the body, the vibrant quality, the vitality of the body. Feel that in the body. Can you feel your own warmth? There are two kinds of warmth. Rub your hands like this and feel if you're not going warmer. Now that's called lower heat, temporal heat, the heat of friction. We're going to talk about another heat later on. But in your physical body you can feel heat. And as your blood is going round, it's obviously rubbing, isn't it, on the walls of the arteries, and veins, and in the organs. And whenever there is a resistance to be overcome, the blood going through it frictively is warming that part, isn't it? Now, in that life force, which you get from the sun, there's a totally different kind of rightness. There's a rightness that we call the aesthetic rightness, the rightness of feeling like and dislike. On your little finger, where your body is, you know you have a body by a sensation, independently of liking or disliking. But that sensation, which may not be coloured by like or dislike, get hold of one of your fingers and feel it, and you won't like or dislike it, unless you start pinching it too hard or stroking it. So we have to distinguish between the sensation that gives you evidence that you have a body and the like or dislike of certain processes within the body. Now, if we have a right way, like bending your finger this way and not that way, for the physical body, there must be correspondingly a right way to feel and to have an attitude towards pleasure and pain. Doesn't there? So there is a pleasure-pain right. If you allow yourself to be led by pleasures and to be pushed away by pains, then you are under the dominion of that law of pleasure-pain. And in general, throughout life, it is a good thing to obey it. If you sit too near the fire and you smell burning and you don't feel anything, it could be you. If you do feel something getting hot and uncomfortable, you look down and observe that you are actually charring a bit, ordinarily you would move back a little bit. I used to have to be moved back by my mother, actually, because I was too engrossed in what I was doing to notice such things. And it was rather heavy on booties, blue of course, and other things, so I had to be carried away. Now, the ritual of life, pleasure and pain, fix that thoroughly in your mind, there is a right, a correct way of having pleasure. Pleasure means life circulation. Pleasure is very, very good for circulation of the blood. It's very good for relaxation of the organs. Pain tightens you up. Pleasure loosens you. Pain tenses you and makes you more individuated. Pleasure loosens you and de-individuates you. So that in the life ritual, if you become aware of this fact that when you are pleased, your temperature tends to go up, your circulation increases, your relaxation increases, and your general well-being is increased. That is the ritual for life. Learn to take your pleasures and pains correctly. Generally speaking, pains mean watch it, it's damaging. Pleasures mean it's good for you. But there is a little process called par association. You know what association is? Prefix it with P-A-R, it would be para, but why bother with the A when you've got one on the word association? Para association, means to associate a thing beyond itself. It's actually possible. I remember a very naughty trick that boys used to do. Shall I confess I once did it myself? For the sake of the exercise, I will confess. The naughty trick of boys was to heat some metal coinage, money, you see, and drop it on the floor. And some other boy would come along and go, you see, now he was power associated. You see, he thought all money is cold. And as the Italians say, it doesn't stink either. It's nobody's. Who can smell the owner of a new penny? Nobody. A dog could. But not a human being. They're too busy spending it. Imagine the situation. Power association means when you falsely associate something with something else. And thus make a mistake. Mistake means taking a miss, taking erroneously. You've seen the little boy with the fairy floss for the first time. He sees this great big mass of sweetie sweetie, and he says to Mummy, "Want fairy floss?" And she gives him a great big piece of fairy floss, and he opens his silly mouth and puts it in, and it vanishes. Time for another primal scream, yeah. See what I mean? You see? Again, that charming child. The fairy floss vanishes in the mouth, isn't it? You can get silent reactions too, you know. That's power association. So this great big thing, nearly as big as money, so you thought, oh, well, I'll get the same fun out of it. I'll do out of money. I'll climb over it. I'll eat it. When it vanishes in the mouth. Isn't that terrible? Par association. Very interesting word. Keep it. Every time you falsely associate one thing with another as par association. And you can associate pleasure with something because you had pleasure the last time. You remember, don't you, Trevor? First girl you ever had? Do you remember your first girl, Trevor? Not really, you see what I mean? You remember your second girl? Oh, didn't you number them? You blue beard, you. Do you remember any of them? Or are you struck with guilt? Is the wife in the audience? Is the wife in the audience, sir? No. Not sure. We won't give you away now. Do you remember any of them? Don't tell me her name, but was she nice? Yeah. Was she always nice? I'll give in. She wasn't. Right? So the first time, you thought she was nice, and later on she wasn't nice, you were a bit disappointed, right? You were power associating her, weren't you? Must have been. In retrospect. Yeah, right. Power association of feeling. You like it, and you go back again next Friday. She's out with the Pakistani. I could have sworn that she loved Bond. Power association. Don't forget it. Ring finger. Power association of like dislike. The philosophers might call it the aesthetic level of awareness. Aesthetic means, quite simply, I feel liking and disliking. Now, there's a right way of taking your feelings. Make quite sure the situation is identical to the last time in all respects if you want to get the same pleasure. Because if the situation changes, it might have changed in an essential of pleasure production. So examine it carefully to make quite sure it is actually the same girl and not her sister in her dress. Trained by another thousand, quite out of harmony with your technique. Now, there's another one. Above the level of the life force, running through the life force, there is a rippling process where these ripples intersect, and they produce internally, even without external stimuli, they produce auto-stimulation. Ideas appear in the biofield, ring finger, life force, pleasure, pain, call it biofield, life field. And at the middle finger level, put Saturn. Saturn is the planet governing time. Saturn, Chronos, Lord of Time. Use that middle finger to remind you. Now, the essence of that is that ideas follow one another in series. Serial presentation of ideas. Now, again, there is a ritual. Like in the case of the biofield, your ritual was sort your pleasures and pains out and associate them correctly, not power associatively, with the experiences you had. In the serial life, the mentational life, on your middle finger, you have ideas following each other, one after the other. And in this serial presentation, there's a law of association. And the law of association is fundamentally by similarity. Similarity of form, of time, of space, of sequence, and of emotional tone. Form, time, space, sequence, emotional tone. Following one another, the ideas. Every little idea you have, because it's a ripple in the life field, has an affective charge or emotional tone. Psychological term, affect. Affective charge, emotional tone. This emotional tone is there. It's not been added to the idea like an after gift of the divinity. It is the fact that the life field itself feels like and dislike. It is sentient power. And as it's rippling and intersecting with itself, it produces forms that we call ideas. And they follow each other in this associative manner. Form, time, place, sequence, emotional tone. And there is a correct way of looking at them. The right way. You watch the series of ideas, and you look at the idea, and you make a mental note, as you look at it, of the affect or emotional charge on that idea. And you see how ideas are associated together by similarity form or concurrence in the same time or in the same place or following in sequence like railway carriages one behind the other or mysterious emotional charge. Emotional charge can cut right across all the formal similarities or dissimilarities. It can jump times, places, break sequences, it can leap millions of years, that emotional tone, because fundamentally it is the life force itself. So the rule about the middle finger one, the time, serial, mentational process, is that you watch the affective charge and distinguish between the affective charge, the amount of like and dislike, on the idea, as to its form, as to the time in which it occurred, as to the place in which it occurred, and as to the sequential order in which these ideas followed each other. If you do this, you have the correct ritual for mentational processes. Now, on your first finger, you write comprehension. Pattern, gestalt. Gestalt, the pattern, the whole figure, not analyzed, complete in its wholeness. And what is the ritual for this? The ritual for this is stillness of mind. This is very important. It's the exact opposite of the serializing mentational process. The serializing process is going on moment by moment, new idea, chain of ideas in the mind. The comprehensional does not do that. It stands still. Now this is the difference in yoga between meditation, middle finger, serial thinking about something, and contemplation, simultaneous pattern awareness. Sitting still, sitting in Zazen, sitting still and holding whole reality in your mind. The ritual for this is sit still, don't mentate, that is, do not serialize. Hold your whole being. Let's try a little experiment with some volunteer. How about our friend Michael Graham Jr.? Michael, will you just give me a sentence making some kind of sense? Anything at all. The words come out one after the other. Yes? Anything? What subject are you thinking about possibly studying? I'm not sure. Well, that would do. I am not sure. Yeah? I'm not sure. Now, will you tell me whether you had a feeling before you serialized those words of unsurety? Mm-hmm. When you said, I am not sure, did your feeling of uncertainty hang on to the sentence, I am not sure? Or were you somehow sure that that was the right sentence to say, to express your unsurety? Mm-hmm. So observe, he had hidden in him a feeling, comprehensive feeling. When I asked him to serialize it, he had to feel about, sort out in his mind, and came out finally with, I'm not sure. He serialized what was, in fact, whole. Now, this is very important. When you have meditated, that is, serialized totally about something, you will discover that there was a pattern behind the serialization that held this serial process of thinking and ideation together, kept on the subject. Keep your mind on the subject. Hang on to it. Stick to it. That ability to stick to it implies a wholeness in the consciousness. And this wholeness is your comprehension. So the ritual for comprehension is sit still, feel and look, listen, smell, taste, touch. Use your five senses, but don't serialize them. Feel your body, feel the pressure of the bottom end of it on the ground or on the seat. Feel your musculature, feel whatever you've got, feel your temperature. Listen, sounds outside, rustling, slight movement. Breathing inside. Feel the movements going on inside. They're all going on simultaneously in a pattern. Don't say what the pattern is, that would put you back on the middle finger. Just hold it. That is the ritual for comprehension. Now there's another ritual on your thumb. Observe that those four rituals, like this, horizontal rituals, are all passives. Your physical body can be acted upon by a stimulus from outside. Your pleasure pain can be determined by stimuli from outside. Your mentational theory of thinking is determinable from outside. Your governing concept, your comprehensional pattern, can be imposed upon you from outside. But your will is at right angles to those four. Your thumb is your will. Put on your first finger Jupiter. Comprehension. Jupiter means God the Father. That's comprehension. And we will find that that first finger will show that God the Father, comprehension, is in God the Son, because this is the index finger. This comprehension one is the one that allows you to decide at what you will point before you actually serialize. So, the power that posits this index finger as a form must have come from the will. Now, nothing can impose on the will from outside. That's very interesting. People can beat your body, they can give you pleasant and unpleasant stimuli, they can talk to you incessantly night and day, and they can say, you must become a Marxist, or you must become a Hegelian, or whatever. They can say that, but they cannot affect your will. Your will is at right angles. Your will comes immediately from, as your thumb, springing out of the palm here. The thumb springs up from the palm, and the base joint of the thumb is in the palm. The middle joint is out of it, the top joint is out of it, but the base of it is in the palm. Now, if we observe that in the fingers, you've got three joints in each, and all three joints are not in the palm. They sprung out of it. And the lower level corresponds with the coronation, the drive. The middle level corresponds with your feeling, and the top level with your thinking. So that you have a drive of the body, feeling of body, thought of body. You have drive of feeling, feeling of feeling, thinking of feeling. And you have drive of serial thinking, feeling of serial thinking, and thinking of serial thinking. And you have drive to comprehend, feeling of comprehension, thought of comprehension. All visible and discussable. But in the case of the will, you can think about the will, top joint. You can feel about the will. But the will of the will, the drive, the secret, is not expressible. You cannot express the will of the will. You can express the will of the body, of the life, of serial mentation, of comprehension. You can talk about it. You can express it. You can say nothing whatever about the will of the will. The will of the will is the supreme secret, and it is hidden, like that base of the thumb, in the hexonic field, which Christ would call your angelic level, when he says about the children, their angels always face God. That is to say, your top level of your consciousness, the hexonic level, the pure eidetic, that itself has generated this individual will, but it has never revealed the will of the will. You can feel what it's like. It's very nice to be a free will. You can describe that free will means unconditioned will, unconstrained will. But what will of the will means, you cannot speak. It is ineffable. It is not voiceable, not definable. The will of the will is a mystery. Mystery is a word meaning don't bother to speak about it. Keep your mouth shut about it. Because whatever you say is ab out it, away from and out of it. You cannot describe or define the will of the will. So the ritual of the will is this. Be clear in your thought of the will. Be sensitive to the feeling of what it means to will freely. But in the will of the will, do not speak. Christ said that very simply. Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. The right hand symbolizes power, the will. The left hand symbolizes thought, thinking about it. Don't let thinking know what the will is doing. Because if you do, you will condition the will before you start. The essence of pure willing is that you do not verbalize it. You penetrate down to the depths of being where initiative actually lives. It is a mysterious ineffable, unvoiceable, indescribable. It is the power that initiates. You can feel it. Hold your hand in balance and then do something. Feel that you have the power to do that. Feel it. You can feel it, can't you? What does it feel like to be able to go like that? Trevor? What does it feel like?
Free.
And when you think about freedom, what does freedom mean? Absence of formal constraints. Yeah? But the actual will of the will. What happens when I go like that?
A limbo.
A limbo. You see? And undefinable. The will of the will is a secret. You cannot explain the will of the will to anybody. Not even to your best friend. Try, you cannot. You can describe the feeling of it, the thought of it, but you cannot describe the will of the will. So the correct, the right, the ritual for the will is this. Give the idea to yourself, perhaps even the idea to somebody who asks for it. Describe the feeling, lovely, free. But the will of the will, don't waste your time with that one. The will of the will rests in itself. And its symbol of the thumb is Venus. Now don't be fooled by that Venus sign. Put the sign of Venus, circle with cross below it, on the thumb. And remember that Venus was not a woman in the ancient world. Venus was a mature man. Big man, plenty of muscle, plenty of whisker. Venus meant penis. Venus meant power, intelligence. Fei nous. The nous is nous, intelligence. Fei meant analytical power. Think, P-H-E, positive power in field. Fei, N-U-S, nous, intelligence. Fei nous. It has become, through a process of historical devolution, Venus, and was turned into a woman at the time the patriarchs took over from the matriarchs. But don't be fooled by the sign of the planet Venus. Venus does not mean female. It means the intelligence that knows how to posit power in the field, and that can analyze, penetrate into, find the joints, dissemble, loosen a thing that is tied up. That is the will. And then there is the right of the overseer, the palm, the episcopos, the bishop. Your palm has given birth to these five, and this ritual is the one described in the Bhagavad Gita. Worship is continual remembrance. The right of the episcopos, the overseer, the bishop, is the right whereby one remains continuously aware that these five are functions of your being. You are your own bishop when you overlook, and remember, you have a body, you have life force, feeling like, dislike, you can serially meditate, you comprehend, you have an initiative power. When you remember these simultaneously, you're your own bishop. And if you don't, you are not. That is the right of the overseer. There is another right. The whole hand there is in space. And it is that space that precipitated the universe. The right of space is called the right of voidity, the right to be nothing. The right, when somebody is trying to read your mind telepathically, to scrub it out so that you're not there mentally. Extended intensely in the appropriate way, you become mentally invisible. You may even become physically invisible so that people can't see you. Because you have blanked out. You have the right of voidity. Women know quite a lot about this, don't they? You know how to void yourself, Sheila? If Herbie is trying to get at something.
I think I can analyze it, but I know what I have to do.
Yes. You know what you have to do, and you can't analyze it. See, so where were you seated? Weren't you seated in your will of the will?
Yes.
Yeah? You can't explain to Herbie, can you? Try, just for fun. Explain to Herbie the will of the will. that wonderful thing whereby when you're trying to get at something, and you know perfectly well what it is, but you're not going to get at it, is he? Why not?
Beyond this level.
That level?
One, two, three.
Three. You can't comprehend it all. Mm-hmm. So you
can't
give it away, can you?
No, I'm not being critical.
No. Not being critical, Helen. Yes.
I think
it's okay, Helen.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can make that loop
yes.
That's not a conceived statement, it's a sort of
it's an if statement, isn't it? It's a sort of gift from somewhere or other, essential in your being that you can do it, isn't it? I mean, you didn't work hard to do it, did you?
No.
No, you've always been able to do it, haven't you? Far back as you can.
That you've been talking about.
That makes you reflexive. And it's the aim of all ritual to drive you ultimately to reflexivity, so that you actually know what you know instead of just knowing it without knowing it. Yeah? So we have this mysterious group of powers. We could add them up. If we count the spaces in between the fingers, we will finally finish up with the number 13. And we're going to examine these again in a slightly different way. In primitive societies, if we go back far enough, we will find that the relation we call symbiotic, when beings are living together in such closely intimate contact in their living field, they cannot separate themselves out. Babies are not separable from their mother. Now the type of this is the baby in utero. The baby is not separate from the mother. Call that the symbiotic relationship. That is a life interpenetrating another life field. We put the life field on the ring finger, didn't we? And this life field and this life field are interpenetrating. These two lines are not separable. I want you to imagine that a long time ago, all that we now call the human race had its ancestors, and that they were not in any way separable from each other. It's a state called panic living. Now, pan means all, is a Greek word, meaning nature as a whole unanalyzed. And in that state, if a man was bitten by a tiger, then the whole community felt the bite. We call that a protopathic, non-analytic, non-separable condition. Now how would you like it so that if I went and kicked Greta on the shin, everybody's shin ate? Would you like it? Or would you rather Greta have it? David Hume once said, he was a great skeptic, he said, why should I bother about the death of 100 people if the alternative is my finger being pricked? My finger, and the pin in it, hurting. If I'm totally self-centered, the death of 100 other people means nothing compared with a pinprick. So if I have to choose, I will have to say, shoot that 100 people. I don't like pinpricks. That would be thoroughgoing, true, separative egotism.
Well, wouldn't they feel the birth of that baby?
Yes. In those days, in the protopathic panic state, everybody felt everything that happened in that group, the family, the tribe. Nobody was separable. And the whole thing rotated round the right of the mother. The mother had delivered the babies. The babies had delivered the babies. And they delivered the babies. In three generations you had a tribe. And the mother who had started the process was supreme goddess. If you look at her in the Willendorf virgin shape, you will see she has no feet, no hands. She's got lovely thighs, a great tum, marvellous bosom, no face, tight curls. She's the Willendorf virgin. She sits on the throne. She has no feet because she doesn't need to move. The children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren are doing all the work. She has no hands. She doesn't need to feed herself. Because the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, they come, they put food in her mouth. She is the author, the origin, the source of their being. And whatever she feels like, everybody feels like. If she frowns, everybody frowns. Think what that's like. Great-grandmother has frowned. We have all to go about the house like this. You know what it's like, don't you? Remember that rule, biogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That means that the process of individual development of a single life copies exactly the phylum, the large category of the race from which you derive. So, you've seen kiddies. Great-grandmother is having a nap. It passes down the line, doesn't it? Have you ever crept about on tiptoes? So as not to disturb some worshipful ancestors? Yeah. We're bound to repeat some of our ancestral experience, either reflexively or non-reflexively. Now imagine in that state, the protopathic, the panic state, we were all symbiotic. We lived and we had a field that had not yet been separated. It is incorrect to call it a common field, because common means counting together, and they did not count. They hadn't learned to count yet. They were not separate. Community is a much later idea. I want you to think the type of it is in utero, where the baby is not separated from the mother. Now when the baby comes out into the world, the ritual has changed. Because the ritual in utero is that mother does the eating and child gets the feeding. If she likes to go on gin and tonic or methylated spirits, baby drinks methylated spirits. Mother is the boss. There is no argument. So the ritual for that super panic state is all comes down from the great grandmama, the Maha Ma, as they used to say. Even greater than the Maha Maha Ma. That was sort of ultimate of all Maha Ma's. That was when the one that was visible on earth claimed absolute descent from the infinite power of the original Maha Maha Ma. Your ordinary man is a Ma. Her ma's a maha, ma. And her ma's a maha, maha, ma. Am I talking Japanese at the moment? I'm getting that time I commit harakiri, I think. Now, when the baby comes into the world, there's a new ritual. He falls out. She's not used to the process yet, so he falls on his head. Oh, new emergent. Bang on the napper. New emergent, signal. Never had one of those before. Gerhardt? We didn't rehearse this, by the way. Right. New emergent. The individual out from this symbiotic relationship. Does this little child enjoy everything the mother makes it do? No. Some of the things, like washing behind the ears, he doesn't like. So, within the meaning of individuality, there is not only the recapitulation of the symbiotic relationship, there is not only the recapitulation of absolute union with the mother, with the grandmother, with the great-grandmother, with the sisters and brothers and cousins and so on. There is potential individuation there. And we said put Mercury on that thing, didn't we? Mercury is the god of commerce and the god of quickness and the god of individuated behavior. He's the god of thieves, rogues, businessmen, anything that's got any intelligence of an individual order. He is the god of it. That means to say that when you're an individual and you fall out on your own head, it sharpens you in a way that it doesn't sharpen you quite when Mother falls downstairs when you are still inside. Falling on one's own head is different from falling on Mother's head. So here we have in the individual a new right. If there's going to be falling, make sure it's not you. This is the beginning of egoic consciousness. Now, what ordinarily tends to happen when baby falls on its head, it screams, mother instinctively rushes and picks it up, and the child then regresses back into this original, whole, pre-individuated level. It is now one with the original source of life, and gets comforted. Now, if we are not careful, something will go wrong at this point. Every time the baby falls, it will run to mummy. It will power associate, because it will run to mummy, even if it gets a little hurt. Have you ever put your finger in your mouth to get rid of a piece of chewing gum and accidentally bitten your own finger? Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen it to mummy to be kissed better? Have you? No? You remember that? Bit finger? Ah, magic. Restored. Now, if you do this too often, your ritual has gone wrong, you all. Hasn't it? Which is very important. Remember, everything has a positive and a negative. The positive of egoic awareness is individual freedom. The negative of it is isolation. Alienation from the group. And what happens then? If you are an individual and on going to mummy with your newly bit little finger, she looks at it quickly because she's busy knitting and says, no blood, go away and play. Alienation, rejection, the source of life has cut me off. And what does the child do then when it's alienated and pushed away in this manner? Try and find another source. What it tends to do is break with the community. That's very important. To break with the community. Now there's a ritual for breaking. But what happens if it really breaks with the community? Imagine a community, let's say, of hunters. And the hunters, the males, go out and they chase some animal that's quite fierce, a wild boar perhaps, or a bison or something. If they have a sufficient number of men, they can kill it, can't they? If they have an insufficient number of men, what's going to happen? They could be killed, maimed, or starved, couldn't they? So if anybody wants to run away from this group, are they not weakening the group? So what is the group reaction to any individual attempt to grow in individuation? Bring him back. The inertia of that ritual is still with us. Very strongly. We cannot afford to lose an individual member of society and weaken our society. So therefore, what does the group leader, the Mahamahama, say about kiddies who run away? From the dizzy height of her mountain of cushions. Bring it back. Yeah. What else does she do? If she's a smarty.
Give it something that will not make it run away again.
Stick and carrot game. Yeah? But supposing it doesn't want this thing, because when it was away, it found an apple. It doesn't want it. You might kill it, and in fact it was done. But there was another method, a threat. What would you threaten it with? Supposing you can't think about anything except your recorded experiences, the content of your own being. What would you think of doing with the baby that came out of you?
Send it back.
Send it back. Now there was a ritual called sending back. You know what they did? Say, do you know where you came from? You like go back? What does baby say?
No.
No? If you get a baby that wants to be treated like a baby younger than it is, I want to be treated like I was treated when I was a baby. Say, okay, how old are you? 5. Okay. So you grab hold of the baby, you strip its clothes off it, you put a nappy on it, safety pins, you put it back in the cot and you tie it down. Right? Now, in its pure form, it was done like this. You can imagine this lady with no feet, no hands, no face, curls, with a thumb like this. Naughty boy, you won't go back where you came from. How does little boy feel?
Terrified.
He's probably already been half smothered by affection. So he's a little chary about that. But to make quite sure the ritual was good and real, and knowing it was a bit difficult actually to fulfill it, what did they do? Instead of doing the actual fact, what did they do? They dug a hole in the ground. They made a womb in the earth. They called the earth Mother Earth. And they dug a hole in it and said to the little boy, you are going back where you came from. And they put him in the ground. And they put the earth on him. How was he feeling? This was called the earth rite. You bury the little so-and-so. Now, if you were a bit short of hands in the tribe, you gave him a snorkel. And you didn't leave him under too long. Just long enough to scare the pants off him. Now, he had one or two reactions to this, didn't he? Either he towed the line evermore, and say he was a sissy, or he thrashed about a bit, and at the first opportunity, he either killed Mahamahama, or he got out. Now, if he got out, he was then what is called hero. Observe that mysterious word, hero. It means the power has now been differentiated. He who has recognized this hierarchy is now going to break it. What is his psychological state, and what is the right for him? The right is the correct thing for him to do. He's going to create a difference. He leaves this tribe, and he starts coming occasionally and knocking off a member of the tribe. He might try to persuade one or two brothers to go with him, or he might just crack a few skulls when they go to the well to get water. These are reprisals against the ones that cause him to be driven out. Right? So there is a right for the hero. Now I want you to put this process here on the light finger, the light dislike, and see that if you get a sufficient number of painful experiences, it will individuate you progressively more and more. Your Maha Maha Ma could keep you, if she was kind to you and fed you, in permanent subjection, couldn't she? Yes? Do you know anybody who's been kept like that? In perfect subjection? I know one or two. The mother knows exactly what they need and she gives it to them. Nobody else does. True. Can you believe that somebody would say to his wife, I want the rock cakes made like mummy makes them. Yeah? Now that's a sign, isn't it? That the ritual was there. That mother knew a thing or two. She wanted to keep him in the tribe. She gave him the carrots. Well cooked. But if that boy goes out sufficiently hurt, he is going to go in time, is he not? In time, after a lapse of time, he, by his pains, is going to become progressively more and more individuated. For every pain he receives, because he's non-reflexive, he's going to inflict a similar pain on some member of his commune, if he can. So if he gets very badly treated by the tribe and he's thrown out, he will wait and if he sees a tired member going for water and there's nobody about, he will hit him with a stone axe and polish him off. And he will try to convert as many of the young men as possible. Now, after a time, you will find it's very peculiar, because in this life heroic, he has to go about, he has to hit everything hard, he has to try to get other heroes to join him, but if they're as good as he is, or better, he is in danger of becoming subordinate to them, is he not? In other words, there's a serious danger if a hero knows another hero, that one of them will assume this relation instead of that. You know that, which way up is it? The perfect partnership, 50-50, doesn't exist. So that when a hero goes out, he'd better stay on his own and look for people slightly less powerful than he is to remain on top. Because if they're not weaker than he is, then he will go under, and he might as well have stayed where he was. So he finds a peculiar thing happening. He is progressively more and more isolated by his own heroism, his own getting out, his own differentiation of power. When he goes out in this way, he finds that his alienation from the group has imposed tremendous things on him. What happens to him in his isolation, in his alienation from those? He tries to make a group of other heroes, but he has to watch these heroes. You read your Greek mythology. Don't these heroes fall out with each other? Don't they lose their tempers? Don't they get so mad that one kills another? Aren't they always doing penances for one murderous act or another? And so, the heroic tends to move towards, through his alienation, a feeling of misery. He tends to go into Saturn. The symbol of Saturn, time, the repetition of the process and the alienation in time and space, make him melancholy. So that the classic symbolism of Saturn means dark, black, melancholia. He becomes ascetic. He becomes aware that this heroism doesn't necessarily pay off. And when he gets a bit older, as heroes do, does not his physical power begin to diminish? What does he do then? Does he still feel like fighting? Or has he, through time, accumulated wisdom?